Welcome everyone to iloveRealEstate.tv. Great to have everybody here and listening to the podcast. And I'm really excited about the upcoming podcast that I've got coming for you, because I've got something planned that's very, very exciting. I'm going to be talking about some international stuff with you. But today we've got to clear up on some of the things that we've got to do back here in Australia before you venture off and do anything at all, whether it be going to property and buy stuff in Australia or whether you buy property on an international basis. Basically, all of these loose ends need to be tied up now. I was reading some documentation the other day, and it said that 40% of the Australian population doesn't have a will. Can you believe that? 40%. That's absolutely astounding, particularly when you look at what actually happens when you actually die without a will. And there's one thing that's absolutely certain in this world, and that's death and taxes. So unfortunately, you can't get out of either. So you may as well prepare for both. So to help us out on the will side of things, we actually have a very dear friend of mine who is absolutely fabulous in this department, and his name is Derek Skye from Pacific Law. Are you there, Derek?
I am here, Dimka. Hello to you and to everybody.
Hey, hey. Now, let's talk about your favourite topic, dying and wills.
It sounds a little morbid when you put it like that, Dimka, but I do spend a large proportion of my day focused on what happens when people's lights are snuffed out, I guess you can say.
Well, let's talk about that. Now, 40% of the Australian population dying without a will. Let's talk about that first. What actually happens if somebody dies without a will?
Well, what that means is that they have died intestate, and the actual process depends upon the jurisdiction in which they've died or the jurisdiction in which they own assets.
Right.
The states around Australia have various intestacy provisions which describe what happens to people's assets when they've died without a will. And the actual process or what happens to their assets varies depending upon what state they're in. And to give you an example, here in Queensland, If somebody dies, then their assets are split between their spouse and their children in a particular proportion according to the Succession Act up there.
So if someone dies and, you know, they think, oh, well, it'll just go to my, you know, my wife or my husband, in actual fact, it could go to a very unruly child as well.
Absolutely. And that's a circumstance that I faced with a client who was fairly comfortable that he didn't need a will because his wife owned the house and he thought it would all go to him if she died, and that a will wasn't necessary to ensure that that happened. But that wasn't the case. And he was sitting in my office with a fairly cranky and moody 15-year-old daughter when he was saying this to me, and I had to explain that the intestacy provisions might mean that he was sharing the roof over his head with that daughter if his wife died without a will.
And I bet he wasn't too pleased about that.
No, we got a will sorted out fairly quickly after I explained that to him.
Okay, so the first thing is we've got to have a will. Now, how do you feel about these will kits and things that you buy at the news agency?
Well, because I do disputed estates as well, I love them. They're great for generating disputed estates. But in all seriousness, they're actually a little bit dangerous. I've probably reviewed a dozen or so do-it-yourself wills in my time, and only two of them that I can think of were valid and effective and actually put in place what my client thought that they were doing. And so that they are a little bit dangerous. And they're also, one of the main issues is that wills only deal with part of your estate, and so do-it-yourself will kits are only ever going to deal with part of your estate, even if they're done properly. And the unfortunate thing is that they're often done incorrectly. They're failing to address or to gift all of the assets that a person might have, and they fail to properly appoint executors, or they might just not be signed correctly. And that's a circumstance, in fact, I've had in my office today, where a gentleman died with a do-it-yourself will kit. The gifting provisions are fine. He gave everything to his wife, but she witnessed his signature on the document, which would be a technical invalidity for the document.
So what happens then?
Well, in that case, we're going to be able to ask the Supreme Court to recognise the document, because there are, in most jurisdictions, the ability to recognise what we call informal wills that don't meet the technical requirements. But it's going to mean additional cost for that client, and the additional cost is going to outweigh my cost that I would have charged for preparing a will for this client. And it's also just inconvenient, and when there's a grieving widow, not really wanting to spend all of her time with me at this stage of her life, she gets to have a couple of extra conferences with me, sign a few more documents than she would otherwise have had to do.
Yeah. Okay, so what are the types of things that invalidate a will? You mentioned one there about somebody who is a beneficiary of the will actually witnessing the will. What other sorts of things? I mean, I've sort of heard all sorts of horror stories about different coloured pens and all that kind of stuff. Is that true, or is that just a load of rubbish?
Different coloured pens can be an issue that you just have to explain. It started off as a tradition where you can help establish that everybody was present at the same time by using the same pen. And now, certainly in Queensland, it's almost come to the point where if you haven't used the same pen, they're presuming that you weren't in the room at the same time. But there are all sorts of technical requirements for signing wills. And mostly, depending on the jurisdiction, but mostly they're things like having two witnesses that are all there at the same time and signing the will together, signing on the foot of the document or the foot of each page, having it printed in legible English, that sort of thing. And so the sort of technical invalidities that we see are not having enough witnesses, the witnesses not signing each page, or even the testator, the person who's made the will, not properly signing the document not being dated. All these sorts of things can lead to an invalid document.
All of those things means that the will is not worth it.
It may be difficult to prove that it was intended to be a last will. If it's so invalid that it just looks like scratchings on a serviette at the restaurant or something like that, it could be that bad. Or it might mean that we just have to take extra steps for the court to recognise that it's a valid will and make a grant of probate based on that will.
A lot of people that I talk to, because obviously, in the financial world, you talk about a lot of different things, have done wills years and years and years ago. How often do you actually have to review your will?
Reviewing your will is something that should come up with births, deaths and marriages, and also when you acquire assets. We have a rule of thumb that every 4 years you should have a look at these things. But really, if somebody's had a child, that's a good time to think about it. If somebody has died, that's a good time to think about it because you might have made a gift to that person or appointed them as your executor. Or if people are married, that's a good time to have a look at it. I often get people say to me, I've got a will, but I made it before I was married. Well, a marriage will invalidate a will in most jurisdictions, so those people actually might not have a will at all. And often buying and selling properties are changing the gifts that you've made, changing the proportion of gifts between children, that sort of thing. Also things like setting up companies and trusts where the assets might not be controlled by the will at all, but you need to think about what you would want to have happen to those structures when you've died. That's a good time to review your will as well as part of the whole of your succession planning.
Does a divorce invalidate a will?
Usually a divorce, depending on the jurisdiction, will revoke the appointment of your ex-spouse as an executor, and it might revoke any gift in favour of that person specifically, but it might leave the rest of the will intact. And so that might still continue on to be a valid will, but of course you would want to review your will, but not just when you've divorced. But when you've separated is a good time to have a review of the will, because you may not actually want your entire estate passing to your soon-to-be ex-spouse, even if they're not quite your ex-spouse just yet.
Mm. And I know a lot of people actually get caught in that scenario too, where, a separation takes place and the last thing they think about is going and changing their will. And,
well, that's right, yeah.
The money goes with the person they're fighting the most with.
Absolutely. The person that they're probably least in favour of at that particular time can stand to gain, and they're very unlikely to put their hand up and say, no, I don't deserve this because I've been a bad husband. But they're more likely to say, thank you very much.
Okay, so we've talked about the things that can invalidate a will and things like that, and, when we should be renewing them. Now, let's talk about the beneficiaries, because, I've often heard the argument that, what's the point in having a will, because it can be contested anyway and everyone can go and have their slice. How do you feel about that?
I understand that point of view. There is this, what we call the social legislation, that obliges testators or people that are making their will to take care of certain beneficiaries, or the court might intervene. And so that's really in response to a claim that might be made on their estate, which might be called a family provision application, a family provision claim, or a testator's family maintenance claim, something like that. But people do often say to me, there's no point making a will, they can be contested anyway. And I understand where they're coming from. But it's much easier to contest circumstances if there hasn't been a valid will put in place, because for a start, they're relying on intestacy provisions, which might include that person anyway. But there's not only a benefit in having a will put in place, there are things that can be done that don't necessarily strictly involve making a will. In most jurisdictions, notable exception of New South Wales, there is the opportunity to structure a person's assets so that their estate might be minimised, which might minimise the likelihood of a claim. And what I mean by that is a family provision application in Queensland, for example, is very strictly made against the assets that are in the estate. And the only assets that are in the estate are those that are personally owned by the person that has died. It doesn't include superannuation, it doesn't include trust assets, and doesn't include assets owned as joint tenants with other people. And so if we are anticipating a claim being made in an estate, we can restructure the affairs to either make it extremely unlikely that somebody would want to make a claim against the estate in the first place, or to limit the actual estate that's available to them even if they make the claim.
Now, you talked there about, you know, reorganising your assets before you die. Obviously, if you did that, such as sell a property to, you know, out from yourself to a trust so that it's not included in your will, or, you know, move assets between superannuation and things like that, that, you know, there's some big implications with that when it comes to stamp duty and in some cases capital gains tax as well.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes there are big implications of moving assets around. You can't just change the ownership of an asset from your personal name to a trust name just to defeat a family provision application and expect that you're not going to be paying some costs to do that. So there might be stamp duty, there might be capital gains tax, and the cost can be quite significant. And that's a very delicate balance that people have to make. Because for a start, if they're doing it to avoid a claim being made, the claim may never be made. There may have been no intention by the person they're worried about to make a claim against their estate. And so it has to be weighed up how likely a claim is, how effective the actions will be. But usually, if we're paying thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in stamp duty, or we're paying tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in capital gains tax, it might be preferable to the hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees for a disputed estate, or millions of dollars lost out of the estate to the person making the claim in the first place. So it's a matter of balancing up the advantages versus the costs of restructuring an estate. Mm.
And what happens when you move states? Is there anything has to be done then?
Wills will be recognised, for example, throughout Australia. Most jurisdictions have provision for recognising wills no matter where they're made. It's just a matter of meeting the technical requirements, which are virtually identical throughout the states. So the will may not need to be drafted or redrafted when you go from state to state. Some of the states have important differences, like the concept of notional estate in New South Wales, where a lot of things are deemed to be part of an estate, even though they are strictly not personal assets of the person that has died. So where I mentioned before that trust assets, super assets can't be claimed against, that's not the case in New South Wales. Those assets might be back on the table because of this concept of notional estate. And if somebody has very carefully structured their succession planning to avoid a claim by a subsequent spouse or children from a previous relationship or the unruly child that they don't want to benefit, and then they move to New South Wales, they might have made all of that succession planning pointless because they've opened up the door to somebody making a claim on the basis of a notional estate. But not only that, even if somebody is entirely resident in Queensland, for example, but they own an asset or more than one asset in New South Wales, that ownership in New South Wales might open the door to people making a notional estate claim, even if the assets are held through a trust structure in New South Wales, for example.
Against that asset only or against the entire estate?
Well, it depends on the particular circumstances. There's a good lawyer's answer for you.
Yeah, thanks
for
that.
But it's mainly the assets that are held there that are of concern. And other assets, so from the point of view of moving jurisdictions, it's a matter of checking whether there's rules that have changed when you're changing jurisdictions. But some of the more immediate concerns or immediate differences between the states have more to do with enduring powers of attorney and advanced health directives and that side of the succession planning spectrum, rather than wills, which might generally speaking be pretty much the same throughout the states. But the enduring powers of attorney, which is a document where you appoint somebody to take care of your affairs during your lifetime so they can make decisions for you, those sorts of those documents can vary quite significantly between the states. Where in Queensland we have one document, an enduring power of attorney document that appoints a financial attorney and a healthcare attorney for you, so one person could make that, both of those decisions for you. Whereas in New South Wales, the enduring power of attorney is strictly financial, and there's a separate document to appoint a guardian to make healthcare decisions. And then in Victoria, it's different again, with a power of attorney for financial matters, a power of attorney for medical treatment decisions, and then a guardian for lifestyle decisions. So those sorts of changes can be quite significant, because if you're making an attorney document in one state and then move states, it might be more of a practical difficulty, but if you're dealing with a bank or an aged care facility, for example, and wanting to be able to make decisions for somebody, they may not allow you to make those decisions if they're not comfortable with the document. Even if legally there's a right to be to have those documents recognised, it might be confusing for somebody that's, for example, a nurse at a hospital, and you're wanting to make decisions about turning life support machines off. Or if it's somebody at the bank and you're wanting to operate a bank account and it's a power of attorney document that they've never seen before, you could find yourself facing some practical difficulties.
Now, you must see a lot of people, you know, we talk about disputed estates and things like that, that, or even in the forming of the will in the first place, where people can make a claim because they're financially dependent or a dependent of I can't remember the legal terminology. Now, you know, what kind of situations could arise there?
Well, there's all sorts of situations that can give rise to a circumstance of dependence. And so it might be children or a spouse, all sorts of relationships. It may not even be a child or a spouse, but somebody that lives with a person who considers themselves to be financially dependent and then makes a claim on the estate of somebody that's passed away. And I often, one of the biggest surprises that people have is that I'm often told by people that, you know, for example, they've looked after Mary during her lifetime to a large extent, and so they want to leave more of their estate to Jill. And they'll say, I've taken care of Mary, we've helped her all her life, and now it's Jill's turn, we'll leave her the bulk of the estate. And the irony is that by looking after Mary for most of her life, they've actually created a stronger dependency for Mary than they have for Jill, which means that Mary has a pretty strong claim against the estate if she's not left an equal share, or maybe even if she's not left a majority share of the estate. And people often want to swing it around and say, well, now it's time to take care of the other children, when they might have actually created a circumstance where they're even more obliged to take care of the child that they've looked after for the last couple of decades. And so there can be this vulnerability from people that make that claim. But often it's people that are a bit of a surprise to the other surviving members of the family. I've seen many circumstances where children of a deceased parent coming in and saying, look, Dad was single, he wasn't in a relationship at the time he's died. And then lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, we get a letter from a lawyer acting for somebody saying that there was a relationship. And maybe there was, and maybe there wasn't. And sometimes the children aren't the best people to judge whether there was a relationship or not. But certainly from their point of view, there wasn't a relationship. But maybe now there's a claim against the estate from somebody saying there was.
And then a court has to go back and prove whether there was or wasn't a relationship.
Absolutely.
Gosh, that's messy.
And it's not always clear whether there even is a relationship when you're looking at it at the time. I've done wills for people very recently where they live in separate houses, they travel together, they share some expenses. One of them spends more money than the other on domestic expenses. They share domestic duties. But they weren't sure themselves whether they were in what they would consider to be a relationship, in inverted commas. And if they're not sure, then I can tell you that it's harder for everybody else to determine that. And it's even harder when there's nobody available to give evidence. So if those two people that are in the relationship aren't available to explain it, then it's even harder.
So tell me, one of the other questions that comes up all the time is, other than legal will kits, which we've mentioned, but public trustees, where you know, they'll do a will for you for free, and you know, and they then obviously take a stake in the estate in administering it as a as an executor. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, the public trustees is an office where you can get good results and bad results. Some of the leading lawyers in succession planning are working in the public trustees' offices in New South Wales, Queensland, all around the country. Whether you will deal with them when you go and get your will done or not is probably very doubtful. And so there's some people in there that are probably see themselves as just functionaries getting things done as well. Often we have seen what you've described, which is people getting a will done by the public trustee for free on the basis that they appoint public trustee as the executor of their estate. And traditionally, when the public trustees take the role of executor of an estate, they don't charge in the same way that a lawyer would charge to act as an executor of an estate. Instead of charging fees for the work they perform, they might charge a commission, which an executor, no matter who they are, executors are entitled to charge a commission. Whether they would successfully claim it or how much that commission might be would vary, but the public trustee might charge a percentage of the estate. And even in estates where there might be minimal work performed, they might apply that percentage. And I've been involved in the periphery on it in an estate which had many millions of dollars, and the public trustee in the relevant state was charging somewhere between 3 and 4% of the estate. And so the administration costs on the estate were something like $60,000 or $70,000, where I would have charged, if I was a lawyer acting in that same capacity, I think in that case I worked out that my fees would have been roughly around $3,000 or $4,000. So when you're making lawyers look cheap, you know that it's expensive. So for estates where there's a bit of substance, where there's a lot of assets or a lot of things to do, they can be actually more expensive. Where there's a very simple estate, and it might even be too minimal, the estate, to warrant involving a lawyer, the public trustee can be very good because they have systems in place and they have methods and they are used to dealing with estates. So it can be a good way of dealing with the administration of an estate. But where my clients have substantial assets, it can often be very expensive. And I also get a lot of feedback when we talk about the public trustees. I usually get a lot of feedback afterwards from people talking about how long it might have taken for a particular estate to be administered, or how many different people they've had to deal with over the course of time. Can get mixed results.
I don't know whether it's a because this will was very, very old. But it was my brother-in-law's mother's will, and it was set up in like 1972 or something. And the public trustee was the was the executor of the estate. But the bill was like $30,000, and their only asset was their house, which was worth about $180,000.
Mm.
And I was like, gee, that's a lot of money to be going for the administration of an estate, which, you know, quite frankly, I could have done.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of result that we often hear from people. And, you know, that can be a bit of a surprise, because the people often are motivated by keeping costs down by going to the public trustee in the first place. And I guess they have saved themselves some money, but if your objective is to make sure that your beneficiaries are looked after and they get as much of your estate as possible, then it's not always the best option.
Mm. The other thing that seems to catch people out, which we mentioned briefly, was owning assets as joint tenants or tenants in common. Do you want to explain those two things?
Sure. It's very important to understand how you own assets when you own them with someone else. And so people talk about owning assets jointly in a very loose way, when there are some very specific and important differences to the way people can own assets jointly. So like you mentioned, you can own assets as joint tenants or tenants in common. When you own an asset as joint tenants, the rules of survivorship apply, so that if one joint tenant dies, the surviving joint tenant automatically owns the entire property. So your will is irrelevant. It automatically passes to that surviving joint tenant.
So how do you tell whether you own it as a joint tenant or tenants in common?
It's disclosed on the title to the relevant property. So if there is a title deed, it will show it on there. Otherwise, a title search will disclose it. And usually it says something along the lines of Mary Jones, and then on the next line, Bill Jones, and then on the next line after that, as joint tenants, which obviously means they're joint tenants. Or it'll say on that last line, as tenants in common, and then it will describe the proportionate ownership, because tenants in common can own different proportions. So it might be as tenants in common in equal shares, or it might be as tenants in common and then a fraction explaining that one of them owns 1/10 and the other one owns 9/10 or something like that of the property. And so if they own as tenants in common, they have a divisible ownership of that proportion of the property. So their will applies. And if they die and they're a tenant in common, they can leave their share of the estate however they would like. And it has very significant implications from succession planning point of view. I've seen a couple come into my office who had a bit of a Brady Bunch situation. They each had children from previous relationships. They owned 6 properties and all of them were as joint tenants, but they each wanted their own will to say, I leave everything I own to my kids. And I had to explain to them that what that would mean is there was really a competition to see who would live the longest, because on the death of the first of them, the properties all automatically passed to the survivor, whose will said, I leave everything to my own children. So the children of the first of them to die was going to miss out entirely. And perhaps on the other side of that coin, I have clients who I was dealing with today where there are, again, they're married, but they each have children from a previous relationship, and the husband in this case wants to leave out his children out of his estate, and he's significantly older, and this presents a high risk of a claim being made against the estate. They own their property as tenants in common, and in that case we're considering converting it to a joint tenancy so that if he dies first, which is the likelihood, the ownership of the property passes automatically to his wife and won't be available for his children to claim against. So each different ownership has its advantages and disadvantages, and that's why it's important to know it from a succession planning point of view.
Now, in that case, transferring the assets from tenants in common to joint tenants, there wouldn't be any change in stamp duty and or capital gains in that instance, would there?
That's right. Speaking broadly, there's no stamp duty payable when you're converting a joint tenancy to a tenancy in common, which we call severing the joint tenancy, or going from tenants in common to joint tenancy. So you can change the nature of the ownership, provided you're not changing the proportion of ownership. You can change it from joint tenants to tenants in common or vice versa without paying stamp duty or capital gains tax.
Certainly something that everybody needs to take seriously, and they really do need to work through these issues, because, well, anybody who's been listening to me and investing the way I say to invest, they've probably got most of their assets in trusts. And, in effect, the will doesn't have any effect on the trust, because you might die, but the trust doesn't.
That's correct. The individuals die, but the trust continues on and the assets are held within the trust structure. The starting point is that the will might be completely irrelevant for those trust assets. The trust deed will determine what happens to control of the trust after the relevant people have died and who can benefit from the trust after the relevant people have died. And so what we need to do when we're conducting succession planning and there's trusts involved is review the actual trust deed itself and see what happens. To make sure that the right people can take control.
And how do you do that? What do you do, like an addendum to a will? Do you do a statement of intent? How do you pass the control on to the next generation?
It varies depending upon the particular problems we might have found in the particular trust deed, because they all say different things. But usually we're looking at either providing in a will a specific clause that says, if I am the appointor, for instance, of the family trust at the time that I die, then I pass that role of appointorship onto my wife or to my kids or whatever the case may be. Or we're signing a separate deed that says that the control passes in that fashion. Again, just today I read a trust deed where the method of passing on the control was very specific. It said that the two appointors can appoint additional appointors by deed, or the surviving appointor can appoint a successor by will. So there's two different methods depending on whether they're wanting to appoint somebody during their lifetime or after they've died, which is fine for most cases, but in this case, the two appointors aren't a couple. And so they might each want to preserve their half of the control, but in that case, they can't do it in their will. They would have to do it by a separate deed, which means it's a little bit more expensive to deal with because a deed has to be prepared, dealing with the control, and it's another deed that has to go along with the trust deed at all times and form part of the chain of documents for that trust.
It gets kind of murky, doesn't it?
It does, and that's why these sorts of things can be very complex. They're not as simple as preparing a will, and they're not as simple as just saying, I want this to happen and letting it happen. We have to work out the basis for how we're going to pass on control and all that sort of thing. So we have to work out where the assets are held, what assets there are, where the control of the trusts lie, and where we want it to pass. And the scariest thing that I hear as a succession planning lawyer is somebody coming into my office and saying, it's very simple. Because invariably it's followed by, it's very simple. I've got three wives, four children from different people. I've got trust assets that have debts to other related entities, and I'm leaving the country in 3 days.
Good. So tell me, where should we keep our will?
The original will is a document that I usually keep for my clients in securities, but people own their will and they can keep it wherever they like. It should be kept somewhere safe. Because if it's destroyed, it can be very hard to deal with an estate. It should be readily locatable as well. So it's something that you should tell executors and reserve executors where it's based. Some people have safes in their home, or they keep a safety deposit box at the bank. But usually they're kept in the lawyer's office, where everybody knows where it can be located when the time comes.
Very good. So have you got any pearls of wisdom to pass on to the listeners?
Well, I think the main thing is whenever somebody's talking about succession planning, you've got to work out the basics and get it done right. You've got to identify the assets, work out where they're owned, whether there's any particular loans passing between trusts and companies and people individually, which helps work out where the equity and assets lies, and then deal with each asset or each structure as a separate issue and make sure that they're dealt with properly as well. Something that we haven't talked about is superannuation, which is dealt with very like a trust, but is a separate asset and it's a very special type of trust. And that's another thing that needs to be looked at very carefully as well.
Because in superannuation, you can make a nomination, can't you, to where your super money goes, which has nothing to do with what's in your will.
That's right. The starting point is the will might be irrelevant. The interest we have in superannuation is held on our behalf. It's a trust interest, and it's called a member benefit. And when we die, our member benefit is converted to what's called a death benefit, and that will include any life insurance that's held through super. And then that death benefit is dealt with at the trustee's discretion upon our death. You can influence the trustee's discretion by making what's called a death benefit nomination. And if you're permitted by the terms of the trust deed, you might be able to make a binding death benefit nomination, which the trustee must absolutely follow. And so it's an important decision for people whether to make a death benefit nomination and whether to make it binding or non-binding. And sometimes the difference of whether it's a self-managed super fund or a retail super fund with one of the super providers is very important as well, because those documents have the same impact or a very similar impact to a will, and yet people are often making them in a fairly blasé way. They might be signing off on them at the financial advisor's office or their planner's office or their accountant's office without really thinking too much about it. But for a lot of people that I deal with, superannuation is the single most significant asset they have, particularly when you take into account the amount of life insurance that people often hold in superannuation. It can very quickly become a more valuable asset than the family home even. And so it's an important asset to deal with correctly when we die.
And that's something that you handle, all of those facets that we've talked about?
Absolutely. I deal with succession planning, which means that I advise people about their will. I review their circumstances to make sure the will is the right document. I deal with enduring powers of attorney and advance health directives. I review trusts and companies for succession planning purposes and deal with superannuation through death benefit nominations and advice about structuring all of those things, either to make the most of their estate, to provide tax advantages, or to try and minimise the likelihood or impact of a claim against their estate.
I mean, one of the things I guess we haven't talked about also is testamentary trusts, which is more of a tax thing than anything for looking after minor children. Do you do much with them?
Absolutely. Probably the vast majority of wills that I prepare these days have what's called a testamentary discretionary trust structure.
Is that because they have minor children?
Not exclusively. There are major advantages from a tax point of view when there are minor children, obviously. But there are also asset protection advantages by structuring the gifts that people leave in a trust structure. And that's effectively what the testamentary discretionary trust means. Instead of a will giving what's called a simple gift, where the proceeds of the estate are perhaps converted into cash and a cheque is written for the benefit of the beneficiaries and on they go with their lives, instead of them having access to the money in their own name straight away, the money might be left in a testamentary trust structure. It may still effectively be the same. People might leave the assets they own for the benefit of their spouse and then their children, but it might be contained within a trust structure. And the trust structure is created in the will. The will itself is the trust deed, and it doesn't come into existence until they die. But then, on their death, all of the assets are put into a trust or more than one trust structure. And there are several advantages to that. Firstly, the tax advantage, which you've alluded to, where you can distribute unearned income to minors and have access to the adult tax brackets, which basically means you can distribute roughly about $18,000 tax-free to each minor, which is a substantial advantage. And yet I find that isn't the advantage that people leap at. Another advantage is an asset protection advantage, where if any of the beneficiaries might be at risk, whether it's from creditors because they're in a poor financial position or because they run their own business, or to a limited extent because they're in a bad relationship with their spouse, there is some protection that's offered by these trust structures because the money doesn't belong to those beneficiaries themselves. It belongs to a trust. And again, that's a great advantage, but it doesn't tend to be the one that people leap at. The third advantage is that you can create a trust for the benefit of, for example, your children, and then if they die, the assets remain under the control of your will, and so can pass down to your grandchildren, for example. So you've left the gift for the benefit of your child, and then if they die, their will might say, I leave everything to my spouse, so to your daughter or son-in-law, but that's not necessarily what you want to have happen. You can leave the assets within that trust structure, and even though your child has died, it continues for the benefit of their children, meaning your grandchildren. And so sometimes people talk about these as bloodline trusts, because you can leave assets for the benefit of your bloodline. And when I tell people that they can leave their in-laws out, that's when the eyes light up and they start seeing the advantage of this structure, even though either the asset protection advantages or the tax advantages alone are probably enough for me to recommend it for most people. The bloodline advantage is the one that people suddenly lean forward in their chair and start rubbing their hands together about.
Fair enough. So how do people find you, Derek?
Probably the easiest way is to track me down on the interwebs with pacificlaw.com.au. Our phone number here is 07-5443-4744, but probably through the website is the easiest way to find us, and we can help out with all these sorts of things that we've talked about.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing all the knowledge this afternoon. I mean, you know, it's a sort of thing that you from a normal person's perspective, going in to see a lawyer about this, get about it anyway. And you get in there and you're so flustered about everything, you forget to ask half the questions. So it's really good to have you on and explain all of these intricacies so people can really think about them and decide on a course of action before they go and see their lawyer and go, okay, well, this is what we're thinking, and be more prepared for, you know, the questions and processes that need to take place.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a lot to think about, and the first meeting with a lawyer about this sort of thing can be fairly heavy going. There's a lot to consider, and having the chance to think about it in advance does mean that time can be cut down, but also you can be a lot more productive in that first meeting.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much. As per usual, Derek, you've been absolutely fabulous. So Derek Sky from Pacific Law, and it's www.pacificlaw.com.au. And don't forget to jump onto the website, which is my website, www.iloverealestate.com. Sorry, it's not .com, it's .tv. www.iloverealestate.tv. And there's a whole raft of podcasts on there for you to have a listen to, you know, on all sorts of different topics, which are all very, very important for you to get that financial basis absolutely right and get out there and replace your income and become financially free, whatever that is for you. And remember to subscribe to iTunes, because that means that they'll come down to you automatically as I record them and pop them up to you. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And thank you again, Derek, for being on the line.
You're most welcome. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.